Hello, Player One. Welcome to the Gaming History Club. My name is Gabby.
Hello, and I'm JP. In today's episode, we look at the history of electronic sports? Esports, anyway. And is it even a sport? Well, let's find out.
So JP, esports is not electric sports, it's electronic sports.
It's basically the same thing.
I think we have to make it very clear to Player One right now.
let's not get technical about this. Electric and electronic. Anyway, I feel like cybersport is a way more future-proof term for esports anyway.
Okay, until cyber is not cool anymore to use.
See, cyber incorporates things like, you know, like serious VR, I guess, yeah? Where it's like, you know, like in cyberspace and stuff.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. I mean, it does sound better.
Mm. Since when has esports actually been, like, a word? Because obviously this has not always existed, has it?
Yes, so esports was added to dictionary.com back in May 2015, and it was defined as competitive tournaments of video games, especially among professional gamers.
Yeah, that feels like it ticks the box.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, I guess it's no secret nowadays that esports is really a big deal. But to what extent esports can be considered as a sport remains a controversial question even to this day.
Yeah. So how do you feel about it, Gabby? Have you always thought of it as a sport, or did it not quite fit the bill?
Well, to be fair, if we stick to the definition of sport itself, they're understood to be like physical activity, aren't they? It doesn't matter if it's a game or competition. It requires training and subjection to rules. And the underlying part of it is the physical activity that's done for reason of health or entertainment. So do we see esports as sport from that definition?
Yeah, so I can see some definite criteria then that a sport needs to have to be a sport then for the traditional definition. So competitive,
mm-hmm,
and physical. So if anything, I guess I've learned that the definition for sports is probably a little bit outdated, if I'm being honest. That's what I feel more like than whether esports is a sport or not. For me, it's quite obvious a sport. So I'm thinking about chess maybe. So you play chess, right? But obviously it can be very competitive. There's grandmasters.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as serious as a sport, isn't it? Like, there's a lot more that makes them similar.
Yeah, we understand it's a little bit counterintuitive if you think about sitting for hours and hours in front of a computer to play video games to be called as sports. Like, come on, if you see the definition, physical activity, yeah. Where's the physical activity of sitting on your chair playing video games? Regardless of the differences between the definition of sports and esports, there are a lot of similarities than differences because they both require skill, precision, concentration, body control, fast movements, endurance, and team strategy. And moreover, they both have fans, they both have players, referees, spectators, leagues, investors, and sponsors. So a lot of similarities.
Everything that you basically are kind of used to when watching a sports event.
Exactly.
Mm.
And I guess when the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, I'm just going to say IOC from now on, when they started to consider including esports as part of the Olympics, you might really want to start considering this as real sports too. Well, quote unquote. After all, these professional esports athletes can spend up to 50 hours per week to train, not just to play like us commoners, basically, but actually to train. Just to give you a little bit of flavor on how popular esports really is, we're just going to give you a little bit of some examples that Player One, you can judge for yourself.
Some flash facts.
Yes. So, Newzoo, a company specializing in video game market data, estimated back in 2022 that the industry generated just under $1 billion, with a following of around 220 million spectators. This means the esports fan base can be compared to that of mid-tier sports, so to say, such as table tennis, baseball, rugby, and golf.
Mid-tier sports sounds a little bit funny, doesn't it? Just like, they're the sports that are kind of all right, but, you know, not really at the top of the league.
I know. It's a bit sad, isn't it?
It's a bit mean, yeah. Did you know, Gabby, there's an absolute huge amount of players in the NBA that own esports teams?
It's quite surprising, isn't it?
I was very surprised by this. It seems kind of left field. Where do all these NBA players come from with their hands in esports? So we've got NBA legend Shaquille O'Neal, been known as Shaq Fu back in the streets. So he co-owns NRG Esports alongside a former New York Yankees baseball star, Alex Rodriguez, and LA Dodgers player Jimmy Rollins. NRG is based in LA and it's a professional gaming and entertainment company. They have a Valorant squad, a League of Legends team, Rocket League roster, and Overwatch League team. So the new school esports a little bit, I suppose you might call them.
That's true. Another one from the NBA is Swedish Boston Celtics, Jonas Jerebko. Sorry if I'm saying that wrong, by the way. He has bought the Renegades team, who's known for Rocket League and Apex Legends, but recently breaking out performance in CSGO and Fortnite as well.
Yeah, we got former LA Lakers player Rick Fox, who founded Echo Fox. They compete in titles like Gears of War, Call of Duty, CSGO, Mortal Kombat, Super Smash Bros., and some others as well.
Yep, and another, well, the last one, really, on our list is actually an NBA team itself. So Philadelphia 76ers was the first NBA team to commit to esports when they bought two esports teams for $15 million. They're called Dignitas and Apex. Nowadays, they compete under the name of Dignitas.
It would have been awesome if the NBA just incorporates esports fully. It just soaks it up. And now all the NBA teams, they also need to have an esports team that compete in NBA 2K, whatever it might be.
Well, we'll touch more on that when we're getting into the Olympics area.
Oh, yeah? What's happening in the Olympics?
Right, so what happens in the Olympics? The Olympic movement began taking an interest as early as 2007, when esports was included in 2007 Asian Indoor Games. There were three games included there, FIFA 07, NBA Live 07, and the last one might be a little bit shocking, but makes sense at the same time. It's Need for Speed Most Wanted.
That is so random. You got FIFA NBA Live and then Need for Speed. It's like the arcade, you know, style racing game, really. Why not Gran Turismo or F1? It's Need for Speed Most Wanted. Getting chased by the cops.
I really like that.
With the Mike Shinoda soundtrack.
But yeah, moving on from 2007 though, finally in 2017, so 10 years later, an Olympic summit was held, focused on the International Olympic Committee. Why did I say that again? I already said we're going to refer it as IOC.
IOC, IOC.
Yes, so the Olympic summit was held, focused on the IOC and esports. They made it clear that although esports is comparable to traditional sports, it would be required that any games used for the Olympics fitting with the rules and regulations of the Olympic movement. The IOC president, Thomas Bach, noted that IOC is troubled by violent games and the lack of global sanctioning body of esports.
They could just not include the violent games, but I mean,
well, that's why.
Does anyone want to see GTA 5 in the Olympics? I don't think there's a big interest to see. Well, I could be wrong. Maybe there's a massive interest to see this happen.
But yeah, I think due to this, the IOC suggested that they would approve more games that simulate real sports, like NBA 2K or FIFA series. Well, I guess RIP FIFA, really. This would be FC Series now, rather than FIFA. Same thing, but okay.
What about Need for Speed Most Wanted? You know, we want to simulate real sports. How can you do that without Need for Speed Most Wanted? Yeah.
Yes, run away from the cops. That's the sport in here, isn't it? But they were open to the possibilities, though, the IOC. They held a symposium to discuss with the esport experts back in 2018. Then in 2019, they made it clearer that they would look at two paths for the games to be involved in the Olympics. Those that promoted good physical and mental health lifestyles, and virtual reality and augmented reality games that include physical activity. But then the pandemic happened, right? Due to COVID-19 pandemic, they held Olympic Virtual Series in 2021, which was fully online. You know, the Olympic that was called Olympic 2020, but held in 2021.
No, I completely blanked that out, you know, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah, I think you already forgot everything that happened in the past 3-4 years.
Let's not mention it ever again.
So the Olympic Virtual Series involved 5 games/sport, auto racing, baseball, cycling, rowing, and sailing. And the IOC eventually announced the creation of Olympic Esports Series in the year after, which then followed by the inaugural edition held in Singapore in 2023. But enough about recent history stuff, right? Aren't we truly here for the real deep history of esports anyway?
Oh yes, player one, it's time. It's time for the best part of the episode where we go back to the past, real deep. And let's talk about the first ever video game competition then. So the first video game competition, let me tell you guys, it is marred by noteworthy people that were all in the same room on a very eventful day. So each one of these people actually ended up becoming like quite a specter in their own respective fields of careers, I suppose, yeah? So let's get a little bit into it here now. The first known video game competition to take place was held in October 1972 at Stanford University, specifically at Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab. Students were invited to an intergalactic space war Olympics, competing, of course, in space war on a PDP-10 computer with the grand prize of a year subscription of Rolling Stone.
Wow. I mean, first things first, I love the name Intergalactic Space War Olympics. I think they already kind of like forecasted since 1972 that they would be in the Olympics one day.
They had full,
which is amazing.
They had full confidence that this was one of the most awesome things to have ever happened. And I agree. It really is.
Yeah, they made Space War on Earth. Amazing.
So I giggled a little bit when I heard the Rolling Stone subscription, but there's a story behind this. So the entire event was actually covered by Stuart Brand, who was working at the time for Rolling Stones magazine. This man was at the forefront of the 60s psychedelic counterculture, as well as like, you know, the cutting edge of technology, you might say. So there's the story where he pushed NASA to release a picture of the entire Earth in true color so that you can see it all in one picture, because there have been pictures of Earth before, but not like a complete picture. Like
whole
maybe just
Earth.
A... Yeah, exactly, yeah. Take that, flat earthers. He actually had this idea whilst having a psychedelic experience on his rooftop, thinking to himself, how nice would it be if we had a picture of the entire Earth for us all to see? Perhaps it would change some things around here. You know what I mean? As you do on a psychedelic trip. So he was very successful in pushing NASA to do this, and it was actually published on the Whole Earth catalog as well. So That's quite interesting, right? This was the guy who reported on this only, right? He founded The Well, which was launched in 1985, and that's a virtual community. That's not the same as like what we were used to with social media. It's a little bit different. This was in 1985, so this was still very much a precursor to like the real internet accessible to the public. But many people found us from AOL, as well as Craigslist. So this is one of their big inspirations as well. So yeah, this was Stuart Brand who reported on it. And I can link an original article where he covers the entire event, as well as the history of Space War 2. And it's a super interesting read. If you're really into like gaming history, this is like one of the best things you can read. It's really, really cool to look at. He funnily also describes some of the contestants to be having like an out-of-body experience, because they're just so hypnotized playing the game. Sounds really awesome. And photographs were taken by none other than Annie Leibovitz. So another hugely notable person in her field, photography, famous for taking a photograph of John Lennon and Yoko Ono just 5 hours before John's murder. So, yeah.
Yeah, she took the picture for Rolling Stones as well at that time, so yeah.
Yeah. So with the attendance of Rolling Stone magazine, the Strong National Museum of Play in Manhattan, New York, considers this event to be the first example of video game journalism to appear in a major American magazine as well. So there's many firsts and very big names here. Bruce Baumgart is the man who won the 5-month freefall tournament, who by day builds sensing intelligence into a robot vehicle at the time. Well, yeah, let's not forget this, the artificial intelligence labs.
Yeah.
You know, we think this is all new cool stuff, but nah, this is like way old. You know what I'm saying? Way old. Tova and Robert E. Mass, better known as REM, won the team competition. And this makes these three people some of our very first esports champions and legends to exist. So I do want to talk a little bit about Bruce Baumgart, just because this gentleman also really, really interesting. So he received his PhD from Stanford in computer science, but he would describe himself as a hacker, hippie, geezer, geek type of person. Bruce also formed Team Overbot, so they competed in the first and second DARPA Grand Challenge in 2004 and 2005. What is that, you might ask? Well, as you know, he's been known to dabble with artificial intelligence. So mm-hmm. this is where you have autonomous vehicles try to complete a over 100-mile long course out in the Nevada desert somewhere. So this was sponsored by DARPA. I think it still is as well. I think it continues to this day. But he took part in 2004 and 2005 as part of Team Overbot. He also plays a very large role in digital preservation. He has worked for the Internet Archive, so that's archive.org. But he also created Sail.dart, computer archive. So Sail.dart is the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, DART. And that is where he collected files from the 70s and 80s that were also accessible to the public at the time. And he just keeps them preserved on his website, sail.dart.org. He was the founder and CEO for 10 years of a global ticketing software business called Softix, and he also worked on Cooil, a short-lived search engine that launched in 2008 and was at the time called by Business Week one of the most successful startups of that year, but unfortunately couldn't compete with the other search engine juggernauts in the late 2000s. So again, yeah, Bruce Baumgart, you know, very accomplished person, I might say, for some guy who's like just one of the first people to win an esports competition. You know what I mean?
He wasn't just a gamer. That's
no,
the part.
Exactly, yeah.
But yes, going back to the early days of video games championships, now we're going to Japan. The old Japan TV Games Championships, or Sega TV Gameki Zenkoku Contest. Sorry if I butchered that, by the way.
I think that was very good, you know.
Hopefully.
It's good that you apologize and be humble about it. I think that was like 99% there. Like, I saw you as a Japanese person just now for a brief second. It was very impressive.
Well, to our Japanese listener out there, can you let me know how good or how bad I was doing in that one? But anyway, it was held back in 1974 and marks the first known competition organized by a video game publisher. The interesting thing about this All Japan TV Games Championships, it's actually really difficult to find articles or any source on this 1974 competition, and there was only one magazine talking about it.
It's very mysterious. I think a lot more research has been done into it, like, since it happened rather than at the time. I think people now look at it like an interest, but very little information about it online.
Yes, and I'm wondering actually if we're looking into Japanese articles that they might have more information to it, but both of us don't really speak Japanese, nor knowing how to actually dig into Japanese media. So apologies, this is all the information that we have.
You would have thought that like playing all the Japanese games with Japanese dubs on would have helped at this point, but No, not really.
You never did.
Turns out, no.
Oh, well, yeah. So the competition intended to bring together video game creators, the arcade, and the gamers to promote interest in the play and sales of TV-type amusement machines. Sega was a major distributor of coin-op electromechanical games before video games existed to the public. There were local tournaments held in 300 locations across Japan, and then 16 finalists from across the country competed in the final elimination round at Tokyo's Hotel Pacific. The prizes included a color TV.
Pretty new and expensive at the time, let me tell you.
Yes, and black and white TV, which is more common. Cassette tape recorders and transistor radios. The event was attended by multiple Sega officials, the press, and representatives from different amusement industry companies. The game played was Sega's table hockey. It's basically Pong game played on a table, so you see it from the top, rather than the now more common arcade-style cabinet that's more vertical.
Yeah, although it was hard to find out what exactly they were playing there, so I've seen another website say that they weren't actually sure if it was video games or electromechanical games, which really annoyed me because if they didn't play video games, I don't feel like it deserves being a part of this episode, if I'm being a little bit harsh. But I did see one side claim that they were playing table hockey, so yeah.
So there you go, then it is video games if it's table hockey.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So it's not that physical one where you have the real puck. Obviously, it's not. It really is like Pong on a table. That's the best way to imagine it, and that's exactly what it was too.
Yeah, so the winner was Osamu Kuroda, 28-year-old banker. So not really from Stanford University.
No.
Equivalent, basically, no. He was a banker, which is just amazing.
He was someone with a lot of 100 yen coins, you know, who played a lot of video games.
Yeah,
that's it.
And really good at it, apparently. So there you go.
Well, sticking to the theme, let's go back to America, though, for a bit. Let's talk about Space Invaders. So Space Invaders, commonly known as the second big blockbuster video game that ever existed, right? So this ushered in the golden age of arcade games, and it often symbolizes video games as a whole. So Atari made a version of Space Invaders for their own 2600 home console, and they released that in 1980. And in the same year, they would hold some competitions, the Space Invaders Championship, which doesn't quite have the ring of Intergalactic Space War Olympics.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, sounds pretty damn awesome. So they held regional events in New York, LA, Chicago, San Jose, and Dallas, with the finals also being in New York. And the person that won this championship would also end up becoming a major player in the video game industry as a whole. So Rebecca Heineman, who was at the time known as Bill Heineman, but also known as Burger.
I think I love that name the most, Burger, yes.
So Burger won the championship. She's considered to be the first national video game tournament champion. Her prize was a tabletop arcade version of Missile Command. So that is a fantastic prize.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Will you buy me that, JP? A tabletop version of Missile Command?
Yeah, it's going to be expensive, darling.
I think so too.
So yeah, she's considered to be the first national video game tournament champion. And although I called the other three, you know, the first champions and legends. So this, no doubt, the Space Invaders Championship was perhaps a little bit more accessible to the public.
Yes.
Compared to Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab, right? So I guess that's probably why this is more seen as the first video game champion. But before winning the championship growing up, Rebecca taught herself how to copy Atari 2600 games because apparently often she couldn't afford her hobby. So she learned how to copy the games and eventually got bored with that and decided, hey, I want to take a look at how these games actually made, and reverse engineered her Atari, right? So then after she won the championship, this kind of became apparent in interviews. So she was actually hired as a programmer by the publisher Avalon Hill. But let's ignore that for a second. So she made some games there and helped make some games there. But she would eventually be one of the founding members of Interplay, where she acted as lead programmer and also designed several games. So in terms of her, you know, list of works, it's a little bit crazy because she helped as a lead programmer. She designed some games. And also, I believe they did a lot of porting, you know, which is where you take a game for the PC, for example, Windows, and you now need to make a version for the Mac as well. And that translation process, that's known as porting. Sorry if I'm not telling anyone anything new here, but just so that we're all speaking the same language, right? So some of her works, though, they include The Bard's Tale 3 and Dragon Wars. Let's talk about some of the ports that she's made or worked on. Baldur's Gate 2, Another World, Doom, Wolfenstein 3D, Ultima 1, and Half-Life, although I think the port for Half-Life got cancelled, unfortunately. That was going to be out on the Mac as well. I don't think it made it there. But there's honestly too many to list. She has also been a big part of the advisory board of the Video Game History Museum. She was part of directors of GLAAD, GLAAD, which is a non-profit LGBTQ plus organization. And lastly, in 2017, she became an inductee for the International Video Game Hall of Fame. And rightfully so, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolute legend.
I find it mind-blowing because you'd think, like, in my silly little head, I'm like, oh, you know, you win, like, this massive, you know, video game competition. But that doesn't mean to say you're going to become the lead programmer of your own video game company and stuff. And these people just took video games as far as they could. And I really like it. I really like these stories for that. So now that we talked about some of the first video game competitions, let's see what's going on in general in the 80s now, which is where our timeline has took us to. I do want to mention Walter Day really quickly. So he was an arcade operator from Ottumwa, Iowa. One day in 1982, he comes across an article in Times Magazine, which is about a young 15-year-old called Steve Urozek, who apparently set the record for Defender, the arcade game Defender. However, Walter Day knew someone in his own arcade with a bigger high score, substantially bigger high score. So he actually reached out to Midway and Namco to find out, you know, where is your leaderboard where you collect all of these high scores then? Because let me tell you, I've got a kid in my own arcade. He should probably be having the world title here, guys. He found out that there was no official leaderboard of any type. So what he would end up doing is founding Twin Galaxies. This was the first national leaderboard for game high scores. And this is why I wanted to mention Walter Day, because for a lot of the 80s, we are getting the high score chase now in competitive game playing. So a lot of it in the 80s was based around getting that high score.
Yeah, instead of doing multiplayer and competition between each other, yeah, they're competing against who can get the highest score.
Absolutely, yeah. This is still very early doors for games, you know, Space Invaders, who popularized the high score table. That only came out in 1978. So, you know, by the early 80s, yeah, of course, high score chasing. That's a lot of what's going on. So we will revisit Twin Galaxies a little bit in future instead, though, because Twin Galaxies is also pivotal in the speedrunning history of video games, and I'd rather pick up with them when we take a look at speedrunning in future. For now, let's take a look at how video game competition evolved to beyond the high score chasing, though. So I'd like to do that by talking about fighting games. So fighting games became really, really popular during the golden age of arcade games, right? Along with shooters and beat-em-ups. And we start to slowly see them standardize into like a format where between the games it would speak a similar language and there's similar concepts and elements and gameplay mechanics going on. Mm-hmm. Genres were actually being built around this time, right? So 1984's Karate Champ was a really massively influential video game for the fighting game genre. Mm-hmm. So it popularized one-on-one fighting games, where now the gamers are actually pitted directly against each other on screen, face-to-face, real-time. Fighting games would continue to build their own identity as a genre, and soon the most common elements, such as a health meter, the best of three rounds, and also the individual selectable characters in game having their own unique fighting style, all of that would be invented and standardized during the 80s throughout different games. This all combined very strongly in the early 90s with the release of Street Fighter 2, so this further popularized the concept of tournament-level competition between two players and setting a very, very strong template for what a fighting game should actually be. So much so that Street Fighter 2, while by far not the first game to have a player versus player mode featuring martial arts, it combined and added its own contributions to the genre and became exceptionally popular in the arcade as well as on the home console, the SNES. In 1996, so skipping forward just a little bit before we end up coming back here again, Evolution Championship Series, better known as EVO, held their first Street Fighter 2 Turbo and Street Fighter Alpha 2 tournament, attracting since its very early inception an international fighting game audience and contestants. EVO to this day is still the biggest fighting game tournament around as well. And Gabby, we definitely have to talk about this a little bit now, because this has given us one of the biggest moments in esports of all time, right? EVO?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we cannot talk about history of esports without mentioning Moment 37.
Yes, also known as the Daigo Parry.
Daigo Parry, yes. So it was at EVO, one of the most notorious competitive gaming moments occurred back in 2004, when Daigo Mehara, playing as Ken, faced with Justin Wong, playing as Chun-Li, in the semifinals. Such a classic, classic pair. Yeah?
That's true.
Yes. Yeah?
Love it.
Ken and Chun-Li. So Daigo and Justin won one round each, leading to a decisive final third round. Imagine if you're Daigo and you're already in this position where Justin took an early lead in this third round, reducing Daigo's health down to its literally last slither. I mean, like one poke will kill Daigo.
Just brief on Ken and he's going to go down.
Exactly. But Daigo, being a champ, took the incredibly risky choice of attempting to block Justin's special move. Remember, this is a special move. Special move is really, really difficult to actually block.
Oh, yeah.
And you know Chun-Li. Chun-Li is very fast with that high kick.
Yeah.
Combo.
So obviously in a lot of games, you hold a button to block and sometimes it'll take off some damage or all of the damage in Street Fighter. So the only way you could like block this attack was if you blocked each individual attack at like the exact right moment, right? And this is a terribly tiny window. Like it's a really, really tiny window. So it's a 60 frames per second game and you've got 6 frames to block one attack, right? So that works out to like 1/10 of a second. So he also had to predict that the special attack would start, okay? Which he did correctly. So the first one was not luck, but it was like pure intuition. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Successful blocking the first one, but then he had to block the following 14 attacks of the special move combo also within 1/10 of a second window. And he did this.
For each hit.
We
need to like make that really clear.
Yeah.
For each hit.
And then, he counters with his own special move combo, which is probably the flashiest way that you can actually, you know, turn the tables of your opponent. And he actually, with that special move, then beat Justin Wong's Chun-Li. So you need to have seen it, obviously, I guess. But when you do watch it, I'll leave a link in the description. You will see eye to eye with me that like the audience there definitely gives it like a way different kind of galaxy, especially when it comes to esports. These guys were shouting, screaming. There was euphoria. There was hysteria. It was absolutely crazy. The room went wild. I saw a really funny YouTube comment where someone thought it was extremely funny that these guys were shouting like even louder than the people who made sure that the Mars rover landed on Mars.
Well, that's esports for you, right? But yeah, this is definitely such an incredible moment. I believe they actually tried to recreate this moment again about 10 years later,
if
I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so
which Daigo actually managed to block Justin's move again. So still the same pair, Ken and Chun-Li, and Daigo managed to do the exact same thing, although he didn't actually win the competition at that time, but it kind of all happened again in front of your eyes, which was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, let's go back to the early 90s. I know that we jumped the gun a little bit just because of this legendary moment.
We had to. We had
2004,
to.
2004, yeah.
To cover moment 37.
I know. There you go. But yeah, back in the early 90s, competitive gaming is taking place across many platforms, many genres, and many nationalities as well. John Romero said that fighting games like Street Fighter 2 inspired him to develop the online deathmatch mode in his 93 PC game Doom. And PC are becoming cheaper and more powerful at this time, so more accessible to households with that lure of the cutting edge of the triple W or the World Wide Web.
I know, yeah. Now there's a point for even the most casual of electronics consumers to maybe have a PC at home, yeah?
Yeah, and I think it even went crazier when the LAN culture started, that really evolved playing as an integral part to how esports teams are often formed, or even training together, played and compete. I mean,
to this very day.
To this very day.
It ingrains the culture as it lives and breathes now, yeah?
Yeah.
I always imagine it in it's one column and they're sat on both sides facing each other. Maybe like four or five, yeah? And then, yeah, that's how they train.
It reminds me of back in school days where, like, in the IT lab, we were all just connected online and everyone playing Counter-Strike, for example.
Counter-Strike.
That's just how it was. And that kind of carried on to all of the game center movement back then, how it started becoming really popular. But yeah, gaming leagues and conventions focusing on online and LAN PC games pop up, such as Cyber Athlete Professional League and QuakeCon, that focus on FPS games like Quake and Counter-Strike. So yeah, no secret there that first-person shooter games at that time, with how online gaming evolved, really was the popular ones.
Yeah, exactly. Going back to my point again a little bit, where I said that starting from the 80s, you start to see video game genres develop. By the 90s, they take on a real identity now as well. Like they're actually well developed now at this stage too. So let's talk about real-time strategy games, for example. Yeah, so games like StarCraft, Warcraft, Age of Empires, Command & Conquer, they gain very, very strong communities of competitive players. But also the home consoles, they obviously still have a very dedicated base of competitive play. And they also see some large esports tournaments taking place. So there was also the Nintendo World Championships, which we didn't really go into. So they consisted of Nintendo World Championships, Nintendo Campus Challenge, and the Nintendo Power Fest that took place from 1990 to 94. And players competed in various home console games there as well. Super Mario Bros., Rat Racer, Tetris, Super Mario Kart and more. It's actually quite interesting because some of these games, they're not actually competitive, so they had to build their own specialized game cartridges.
Mm.
So like for Super Mario, for example, you collect some kind of score. So it was kind of like high score chasing mixed with like head-to-head competitive gameplay. It's a little bit of a bizarre combination. But it's interesting because some of those customized cartridges are some of the rarest and like the priciest collector's items around for video games. They can sell for upwards of six figures. So more than $100,000 for like a single game cartridge, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And also, not just Nintendo, but also other companies were running their own championships and tournaments. Blockbuster is another one of them. Blockbuster Video, they had games such as NBA Jam and Virtua Fighter. But if I'm being honest, there's like a lot of paths now that you can go down when you're looking at esports as a whole, and it gets very complicated. It gets very heavy. Like this is officially where esports massively explode. And it becomes like a very heavy, big subject to talk about with so many tentacles going into so many different areas. So maybe we should just, slow down and maybe find out what is going on now, actually, a little bit.
Yeah, I think from the start of the 2000s until nowadays, esports has definitely grown. but it has been consistent at the same time. With a lot of like games allowing things like spectator mode, actually accommodating people to not just play, but as an audience as well, it's great, right? And better internet connectivity obviously even boosts that esports competition even more.
It's a very good point that I don't think I would have like thought of immediately until you brought it up, because you also see the gameplay first person from the eyes of the competitor.
Exactly. Yeah? You can follow what they're seeing as well, which is really interesting. And I guess nowadays it's a lot more common that people actually have devices, and it became very big. And obviously a lot of these esports games are actually on smartphones too. That's why a lot more people can actually jump to the wagon.
Yeah. There's obviously such a big number of tournaments too, where, you know, we can count all the tournaments held in the 70s on one hand. Now you would need many, many hands, as a matter of fact, like tens of thousands of hands to count them all. Yeah, maybe more.
Yeah, and obviously the perception shift as well, right? With gaming and it's being seen as more sports as well now. We touched about the Olympics and how they started even acknowledging how esports, not just gaming, basically, it can be sports and it involves a lot of other stuff. All of the stuff we talked about before. So yeah, the skills are being acknowledged. You're not just a regular gamer.
No, it's becoming so like normal as well too. Like I'm sure there's so many parents now that when their kid is like playing, you know, Fortnite, Overwatch or whatever, it's not such a big deal anymore where you're wondering, oh, I don't know if my kid spends too much time in front of the computer. Is he not socializing enough? Like, is this bad for his long-term health, etc., etc.? I think people now quite accept video games as a, you know, entertainment leisure medium. It can be used to make money in various ways, but not necessarily at the same time. But I think people now understand, like, okay, this is how to strike a healthy balance. So I think there's definitely that perception shift there as well.
Yeah, funny you mentioned about money, because esports being taken very seriously because of the money itself as well, yeah, that involved in esports.
The ching ching again.
Yeah. Again, right? It's always about
it's
the
always
money.
It's always the ching ching.
So if we're looking at top games in the esports nowadays, and we're looking into this based on prize money, the first one is actually Dota 2. The total prize money that Dota 2 has been given out in competition since their release in back in 2013 is $345 million. And Dota 2 has been played by 4,874 players, approximately, and 1,888 tournaments in total have been held.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. That is a lot of prize money, yeah. Especially for the number of players, because as we see now with the other four, they have a lot more players, to be fair. So Fortnite takes number second, player one, with $180 million prize money.
So that's basically like almost half of Dota, actually, Dota 2.
Yeah, but then finally they have like twice the amount of players competing, so 9,240.
Mm-hmm.
And that's across slightly higher number of tournaments too, 2,170.
Yeah, and the third one is CSGO.
Oh, finally a good game. No, I'm just kidding. No, I like Counter-Strike. Sorry. It makes me nostalgic. I do like some Counter-Strike.
It is great. And actually, that is a testament of how many players play CSGO. So based on the prize money in total, they've given out prize money for $162 million. And there are 16,433 players in total with 6,976 tournaments. Seeing it from popularity, CSGO might be up there, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. I'm very proud of Counter-Strike because, you know, they've always been very competitive, basically, the players, and it's always found its way into esports. So starting from, you know, 1.6, you know, where it was really just a mod for Half-Life, but then continues, you know, Counter-Strike Source, Counter-Strike Global Offensive, like it continues to be able to become a game that is enjoyed competitively. I really like that about Counter-Strike.
Yeah, that's true. And the fourth and fifth on the list is League of Legends and Arena of Valor. So yeah, they're all really, really big games in terms of the prize money that they've actually given out. Most of them on this top five are above $100 million worth. So yeah, if you want to look for some side hustle, player one, who knows, you want to be competitive esports athletes. Yeah.
We'll support you. We will sponsor you, guys. Gaming History Club. We will sponsor you.
$5 per month.
Yes, but it is the easiest $5 per month you've ever made.
Yeah, and we can have our tiny logo somewhere in your t-shirt.
Yeah. So, player one, we've jogged through memory lanes and explored some legendary esport matches. Feeling the fierce fights to get esports being seen as a real sport. I still prefer cyber sports.
Okay.
And although esports is not making it into medal events in the Olympics this year, they've certainly come a long way, haven't they, Gabby?
We're certainly hoping for seeing esports to be one of the medal events in 2026. But anyway, it's still part of this year's Olympics anyway, in some sense. But what do you think, player one? Do you agree that esport is an actual sport? Do you have some legendary competition stories you'd like to share with us? Let us know by dropping us a message on our website, gaminghistory.club. New episodes of Gaming History Club are released every second Wednesday, so make sure you subscribe and follow us on our social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook as Gaming History Club.
Come back in a couple of weeks, player one, to celebrate this mighty game console that has most likely traveled further than you have. See ya.